Okay, so just as a little backdrop before we jump right in here is here's the outline of the book, and I've highlighted in yellow where we're at. We're getting very close to the end, probably three or four more Wednesdays and we're done. We will, of course, have a break next Wednesday with the gospel meeting, so we will resume. Our next class on Job will actually be after the meeting, so it'll be on May 18th, Wednesday the 18th. And we have a young man by the name of Elihu that does his piece, and he goes for six chapters. And so after Elihu, everything finishes, and then God comes in the picture in a whirlwind. So we're getting very, very close to the end of the book. But we're going to be in the past, the present, and the future tonight, 29, 30, and 31. So this is where we're going to begin. Thank you for being here. I've asked Travis if he would to start us off in chapter 29. He's going to go ahead and read the chapter for us. And then we'll start addressing some things that Job reflects on his former glory, his former past life before everything came apart. Okay, Travis.
And Job again took up his discourse and said, "Oh, that I were as in months gone by, and as in days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone over my head, and by his light I walked through darkness. As I was in the prime of my days, when the friendship of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, and my children were around me, when my steps were bathed in butter, and the rock poured out for me streams of oil, when I went out to the gate of the city, when I took my seat in the square, the young men saw me and hid themselves, and the old men arose and stood. The princes stopped talking and put their hands on their mouths. The voices of the nobles was hushed, and their tongue stuck to their palate. For when the ear heard, it called me blessed. And when the eye saw, it gave witness of me. Because I delivered the poor who cried for help, and the orphan who had no helper. The blessing of the one ready to perish came upon me, and I made the widow's heart sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like robe and a turban. My eyes was to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy, and I investigated the case which I did not know. I broke the jaws of the wicked and snatched the prey from his teeth. Then I thought, I shall die in my nest, and I shall multiply my days as the sand. My root is spread out to the waters and draw lies all in the night on my branch. My glory is ever new with me, and my bow is renewed in my hand. Verse 21, to me they listened and waited and kept silent for my counsel. After my words, they did not speak again, and my speech dropped on them. In verse 23, they waited for me as for the rain and opened their mouth as for the spring rain. I smiled on them when they did not believe, and the light of my face they did not cast down. I chose a way for them and sat as chief, and dwelt as a king among the troops, as one who comforted the mourners."
Thank you, Travis. Okay, we're given an insight here of a little bit more about Job's life. He starts talking about how things used to be, and there's quite a few things we want to take note of tonight of what a person this man was, and why God considered him, you know, very, very special. And so in verses 1 through 3, he starts recalling the days before all these calamities struck him down, wishing they would continue. He uses the word "watch" there when God watched over him in verse 2. That really means exercised great care over. So God had exercised great care over him, and the point being is God's care had been over him, had been constant up until now, and God's lamp had shined over his head and had led him through the darkness. In verses 4 and 5. He starts talking about those very happy, those very fruitful days when he was in the prime of his life. These were days when God was a close friend and Job's children were very near. He uses a couple of expressions in verse 6. And one of the expressions is that his life was washed with butter and streams of oil. And that is an expression of speech that he uses to indicate the fatness and the plenty of his prosperity, that God had washed him with butter and streams of oil. And he uses the word rock there also in verse 6, which is a metaphor for a a stone olive press, and the idea being that the oil was pressed out of the rock, and Job was a blessed man. He had all kinds of blessings. So he's reflecting all this on his past. In verses 7 through 10, he starts talking about his position and his responsibility as a judge and as an elder. And he says he had prepared his seat as an elder, as a member of the council or the magistrate. He was respected by everybody in society. He was known to be one of the great men of his time. And the respect, though, was not built upon politics or upon wealth, but really it was built upon fairness. He was known to be a man of fairness, a man who took the rights of people that were being taken advantage of, and he was a man who was known to have concern for other people. And we have basically an illustration here of when Job stood up, or when Job sat in the court and acted as a magistrate. It says that the young men, they hid themselves. They say that the older men stood up and gave him the respect that he would be due. It says that the princes themselves, they remained quiet, and that the nobles were hushed. And so, a tremendous amount of respect here for Job. In verse 11, he talks about the fact that his ears that were there in his audience, ears heard him. Those that had ears that were listening to him, their ears were blessed. And their eyes, people in his surroundings, as they watched the things that he did, they witnessed Job's actions. So respect came from what others saw and others heard from Job. And now he gets in then in verse 12 to why he had earned this respect. And in verse 12, he talks about the fact that because he delivered the poor, he delivered the fatherless, and those who had no one to help them. And if you remember, there's a lot of Old Testament passages where God talks about his concern for the orphan and his concern for the widow. And so Job has taken up that position to be the voice of the poor, the voice of the fatherless, the voice of the widow. And that is the role he took as a magistrate or as a judge. And anybody have any questions or comments, raise your hand as we go. Job rescued the perishing, those that were destitute. Generally the poor had no one to represent them. They couldn't hire counsel. And so he was one that represented the very, very poor. And the widow, he says, their heart were made to rejoice because he helped them. And so that was some of the things of his past. He talks about his clothing, and this is again a metaphor, but in verse 14 he talks about the fact that his fairness or his justice was a robe and a turban. And that apparently was the attire of a judge or a magistrate in Job's day. So there was a robe that he wore when he was giving counsel, and there was a turban he wore on his head. And that was the attire of someone who was a counsel or a magistrate. And so he wore the clothes of a very respected person in society. He continues along the same train of thought in verses 15 and 16. I'll go back and reread those just for a second. He says, I was eyes to the blind, I was feet to the lame, I was father to the poor. I searched out the case that I did not know. And so basically he's saying, I represented the people that were blind, I represented the people that were lame, I represented the people that were needy. I was their eyes, I was their feet, and I was their father. So he was the person who took the position of helping the low person in society, those that had no one to represent them. And there's an interesting, a use of a metaphor he uses in verse 17. He talks about the fact that he breaks the jaws of the unrighteous. And basically he was talking about metaphorically is when an animal attacks another animal, like a lion attacks a gazelle and attacks his prey, their jaws will lock down on that prey and you just cannot get them off that prey. And he's saying just like a lion going after the very weak gazelle, when the unrighteous were going after those that were blind, those that were lame, those that were needy and had their jaws locked down on them, he would break their jaws. So again, another use of a metaphor that he would break the jaws of those that were doing the oppressing, and he was the champion of those being oppressed and those being downtrodden. So it's again an example of an animal that would he would break the jaws of the very powerful that were taking on those that were very weak. In verse 18, he had anticipated in his earlier life a very calm and serene life. Job led a very blessed life, and he was surrounded by his children, by his grandchildren, and in fact he uses the expression there in verse 18. He talks about, I shall die in my nest. That means he would be surrounded by his family. His days would be innumerable as the sand. So Job's earlier life, he thought it would just, you know, he was going to basically ride life out in a very blessed state, surrounded by children and grandchildren, hence his nest. In verse 19 and 20, he uses again a couple more metaphors or analogies. He talks about the fact that he was a root and he and his bow. And let's just read through those for a minute. This verse is 19 and 20. He says, my root is spread out to the waters, and the dew lies all night on my branch. My glory is fresh within me, and my bow is renewed in my hand. And basically, it's talking about Job's root is his artery of life, and his life was like that which spread to the waters of life. His whole life was reaching out and spreading goodness to other people. And his bow, which is a weapon of defense or a weapon to protect people, was always ready, and his bow was always constantly renewed. So Job saw himself as a champion of those that had no champion, is basically what you need to get out of this. He saw himself as representing the small person. And very big difference too, you're going to see a huge difference from chapter 29 to chapter 30, because here he reflects back on how people would listen to him in the old days. In verse 21 he says that in his presence men would wait, they would listen, and they would anticipate his counsel. Verse 22 of this chapter, he says, after he spoke, there was nothing more to be said. His words, it says, were distilled, and that really is the expression, commentators say, is he's trying to express the idea that his words fell gently like distilled dew on the ears of the listeners. So his words came down upon them like a pleasant dew, and they listened to all the words that he said. He talks in verse 23 about the rain or the later rains, and these are the rains that come in April and May for that part of the country. And they were very essential for maturing crops. And the expression here basically, and several commentators jumped on this one, if you go back and read through the commentaries, that men, basically the idea is men would wait around and listen for his words with their mouths open to basically hear and taste his words of wisdom. So they would be like holding your mouth open for the morning dew, to droplets of water to go in your mouth. They would sit back with their mouths open and hasten to hear and to taste Job's words of wisdom. So very, very respected person. Verse 24, he talks about that when he defended other people, those that were despondent, his smile, if they knew he was representing them, gave them confidence. It gave them hope. And so he served his fellow man basically towards the end of the chapter. He kind of starts summing up here in three ways. He served them as a chief and as a leader. He dwelt among them as a counselor, and he lived among them as a comforter. And the kind of in summation of chapter 29 is that Job was a honorable and a very honest person. He enjoyed the prestige. He enjoyed the honor of being among his fellow man, and he served his God. And so this is all reflection on how his past life was. A very, very highly respected person among men. And as we know, being the insider, very respected with God too. You know, Bruce.
I was just going to say, he still has, in this portion, he has God as the one who gives the just all the credit. So mm-hmm. He's the old mindset of God gives and if he's doing bad,
right.
God takes away. God was giving it at this time, and it was all credit to God.
It's all credit to God. And you're going to find Job once in a while slips into the orthodoxy view with his friends, and then he jumps back out of it. But he kind of goes back and forth. And we'll see that in another chapter. I think Dwayne and then BJ.
Job 1, verse 8, the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil."
Yeah. And we're given just a little bit of...
You might think Job's bragging over here.
You're right. But we're just given like a little bit of insight of what his life was like, and he was a very honored man. And BJ.
I think part of why this is recorded this way is we always have to be looking for Christ in the Old Testament scriptures. And chapters 29, 30, and 31 give us the story of Jesus Christ. In 29, you have someone who's come on the scene who is smiled upon by God, who is light, who hushes authorities, who speaks wisdom, who draws crowds. And then in chapter 30, as we'll see, it's laughed at, though, and then it's mocked, and it's torn down, and it's broken. And then 31 is this final cry to God, and this appeal to God. And, of course, we remember the words of Christ appealing to his Father on the cross. And this whole three-chapter series really depicts the whole entire life of Jesus Christ, and perhaps the way and the reason this is recorded about Job is because really Christ is a fulfillment not of only the Old Testament law and the prophets, but really he's a fulfillment as a type of some of these characters we see in the Old Testament scriptures.
Absolutely. And we're going to see a lot more as we continue analogies of Jesus with Job. There's a very, very lot of analogies that we can make with that. So thank you, BJ. Can I get someone to read chapter 30? Kevin, are you up for that? You got a voice for it? It's 31 verses, so let's read quickly through chapter 30 and we'll get into that. Now Job is going to say, but now here's what my life's like. And so now we're going to get into what is current reality.
But now they laugh at me, men who are younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to set the dogs of my flock. What can I gain from the strength of their hands, men whose vigor is gone? Through want and heart hunger they gnaw the dry ground by night and waste and desolation. They pick salt work and the leaves of the sages and the roots of the broom tree for their food. They are driven out from human company. They shout after them as after a thief. In the gullies of the torrents they must dwell, in holes of the earth, of the rocks. Among the bushes they bray, under the nettles they huddle together, a senseless, nameless brood. They have been whipped out of the land. And now I have become their song. I am a byword to them. They abhor me. They keep aloof from me. They do not hesitate to spit at the sight of me. Because God has loosed my cord and humbled me, they have cast off restraint in my presence. On my right hand, the rabble rise. They push away my feet. They cast up against me their ways of destruction. They break up my path. They promote my calamity. They need no one to help them. As through a wide breach they come, amid the crash they roll on. Terrors are turned upon me. My honor is pursued as by the wind, and my prosperity has passed away like a cloud. And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. The night racks my bones, and the pain that gnaws me takes no rest. With great force my garment is disfigured. It binds me about like the collar of my tomb. God has cast me into the mire, and I have become like dust and ashes. I cry to you for help, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you only look at me. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. You lift me up on the wind, and you make me ride on it, and you toss me about in the roar of the storm. For I know that you will bring me to death, and to the house appointed for all living. Yet does not one in a heap of ruins stretch out his hand, and in his disaster cry for help? Did I not weep for him whose day was hard? Was not my soul grieved for the needy? But when I hoped for good, evil came, and when I waited for light, darkness came. My inward parts are in turmoil and never still. Days of affliction come to meet me. I go about darkened, but not by the sun. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I am a brother of jackals and a companion of ostriches. My skin turns black and falls from me, and my bones burn with heat. My lyre is turned to mourning, and my pipe to the voice of those who weep.
Thank you, Kevin. What a difference. Now we get into the present situation, and The way you need to understand this chapter is Job is going to start off describing the rabble of society. The people that are disdained, the people that are the lowest of low in society, even they mock him. And so now he is beneath them. And that's what you need to understand as we get into this chapter, because he's going to describe those that are already the rabble of society, and even those are mocking him. So that's how you need to understand this as we go through. So he starts off verse 1, but now, here's the present situation. The youth, remember the youth would hide themselves from him earlier. Now it says the youth mocked him. They laughed at his pitiful state. And this is a really interesting point here. He says, those whose fathers, the fathers of these youth that now mocked him, he wouldn't even allow their fathers to work with his sheepdogs, is what the expression is here. His dogs were more honorable than they were. And that's really what he's saying here, is that these children that mock him, their fathers, they are less honorable than his own sheepdogs. And so he is really making his point here that, you know, how low he has been despised in society. Their power and their strength were not even worth his consideration for help. Their condition was brought on by poverty and lack of food. And he uses expressions of the rabble of society. They were like people that walked around gnawing on a root, or like a dog that was gnawing on a bone. And these were the same kind of people, he said, that would eat salt, wort, or mallows. Now, those aren't terms that we use. I had to look these up. But salt, wort, or mallows was a bush that bears green leaves, and it grows pretty much in very salty regions. Had a very, very sour taste, and it was eaten only by the poor when just absolutely in dire necessity. He also uses the word roots, and roots were not edible, but it was a section of a plant from a broom plant, and those were used as charcoal to cook food. So he's talking about just how poor and destitute these people that are mocking him are. And these people, verses 5 and 6, found no welcome from people anywhere, and they were driven around in society like vagabonds and like workers of iniquity. He uses the word in verse 7, they would bray, that is, they would cry out for food while searching among the bushes. And they were children, verse 8, of base men, very evil people in society. And they were outcasts of the land. So that's the point you need to understand. He's saying this is the rabble of society. And now he changes gears. He says in verse 9, now this group of rabble, this group of outcasts, were now ridiculing and reviling him. And they even were mocking him in song. So he is now even beneath them. Verse 10, he talks about the fact that they showed him contempt by spitting in his face. And I think there's an analogy here to Jesus. And I'll get you in just a second, BJ. Either at the side of him or literally in his face. Either way, though, this added to his shame and insult and to his suffering. BJ.
I was just going to say, you notice when you read these ancient texts that people in general have not changed from what we see today. And that's that, you know, in our culture today, it's very simple. You are kind and courteous, and you elevate those who are preferred in society and those who are considered heroes or models or do well. But you'll notice when things don't go well for them and when they're in a bad time, a lot of times they're just ignored or spoken poorly of then. And it just makes you appreciate so much more that we serve a just God and a loving, merciful God who is there for us in the good times and the bad, and expects us to not show partiality in the same way.
So. All right. Bruce, I'm sorry.
The thing struck me on this is that he defended people that were like him.
Were destitute, right.
And his cohorts that came to support him and stuff should have taken on that same role, and yet
They didn't.
They didn't protect him. They left him to defend himself.
Right. And now even the destitute in society that he defended, now they're mocking him and spitting in his face. And so,
why?
Because that's just what people do. They were just mean.
You know, if I can look down on you, then
it's unfortunately it's human nature, yeah. But it's very sad. Kevin.
Taken away from the public view
Mm-hmm. Once that authority figure of Christianity or God is gone, and they've conquered the church, supposedly conquered the church in this land, it's going to be the same thing.
Right.
They're going to spit on us. They're going to spit on the Bible. They're same thing. I think it's
right. Now, and we have to, and thank you, I appreciate that comment. We have to remind ourselves too, remember orthodoxy. That was the traditional view of people, including the rabble. If you were diseased, if you were sick, if you were poor, you were sinful. You were scum of the earth. If you were noble, if you were rich, and you had good health, God blessed you. And so Job has now gone from one extreme, you know, to the other. And now even the rabble are spitting at him and the rabble are mocking him. Very reflective again, and BJ and I talked about this several times, of Christ. Remember Jesus went from one day where they're wanting to make him king and they're laying the palm fronds down in front of him, and the next day they're wanting to hang him on a cross. So very, very similar type things are going on here. In verse 11 he talks about the fact that God had loosed his cord and that he's basically... Job continuing here to feel that it is God who is the cause of his source of blessings, but now God is also the cause of his woes. So it's all from the hand of God. And so, but even now with the young rowdies were unbridled, they're continuing to mock him, much like they did with Jesus. But God he still sees as the source of both the blessings and the cursings here. In verse 12, he uses the expression rabble, and that basically means young offenders or revilers. And he says that they were over at his right side, and a lot of metaphors being used here, which was the right side of somebody, as we all know, is generally the place of honor. Jesus talked about being at the right-hand side of the Father. Now these people had pressed upon him. And basically what the commentators say he's trying to say here is they were basically thrusting him aside, possibly pushing him around, causing him to stumble and to fall down to the ground. And so there was some physical abuse going here. Reminds me a little bit of Jesus, you know, as they mocked him and kicked him and pushed him around. But that was the rabble. He says that they were marring. That word means to tear or break down. The added to his woes by contributing to his calamities. And in verse 14, he talked about the fact that in the midst of all his ruin, they came rolling in upon him, and he calls it like an unrestricted army, like an army that doesn't have anybody to defend, and they're just running in through a wall that had already been breached. So it just basically feels like he's just being torn at by everybody, like an unrestricted army. So in verse 15, he's kind of summing up here. He feels that God, the rabble, and all these terrors have all now combined forces to destroy him, to destroy his honor, and to destroy his dignity. And in this next section, in verses 16 through 23, we're given a little bit more insight to his physical affliction. He describes the emaciation of his body and the suffering that he was enduring, both from a mental perspective and a physical perspective. And he talks about in verse 16 that his life was being poured out, it was being drained, and being washed away by tears and by weeping. His days of affliction held him like an animal that holds his prey tightly in its jaws. And verse 17 is where we get into some of the physical description. He says that he had very, very sharp, intense pain in his bones, and his agony had not ceased. If you look down in chapter 30, he says, verse 17, he says, "My bones are pierced in me at night, and my gnawing pains take no rest." I'll read verse 18 too. "By great force, my garment is disfigured. It binds me about as the collar of my coat." He's talking about his skin. And what he's saying here, basically, there's a couple ideas. First of all, the one idea is that he's got a constant, sharp, penetrating pain in his bones, possibly from the disease that he has. But in any case, the pain was non-ceasing. It continued. There's two possible ideas about what he's talking about the collar of his skin. It either means that the garment of his skin is talking about his emaciated body, that the skin now hung so loosely upon him, it was almost like the collar of a coat. He had lost so much weight, and the skin was so, you know, broken out with all of this leprous type, you know, seething boils, that it was like he could just stretch it around like the collar of a coat. The other idea could be that his body was so emaciated that his garment that he was wearing was so loose that the collar could wrap around him. In either case, he's emaciated. He's skin and bones. And so he's very, 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 very destitute here. He says that he, capital H, God, he felt that God had cast him into the mire, verse 19. And then he talks about the fact of this idea, concept of dust and ashes, and that could refer to the color and the texture of his diseased skin, and talking about dust and ashes. So not a good sign for the things that Job's describing here about his physical condition. In verse 20, he says, I cry, he's pleading for help. And in his eyes, God had apparently heard him, but was indifferent. And God simply looked at him. And here Job is speaking without knowledge. And this is one of the things God will address him later at the end of the book. But he feels that God had turned, verse 21, and become cruel to him, and it was God who was now persecuting. So he sees God as both the giver of good things and the giver of bad things. So he sees God in both roles. And the only thing I can tell you is we sometimes, you know, we being healthy and feeling good and here today, it's easy to say, well, Job should have done that. But you got to remember his physical state, mental state, physical state, this guy was really pushed as hard as anybody.
I think that's what separates Jesus from what we read about Job. Job, in turn, blames God and believes that God is far away from him. And yet when Jesus quotes the psalm, "Why have you forsaken me?" the whole point of that psalm and context, and that's how they would have understood it, is that God has not forsaken his righteous one.
Right.
And Jesus knew that this was always a part of God's plan that he would have to suffer. And so it just makes us, as we read this, appreciate, even though Job was righteous and blameless before God, not even he can be compared to how Jesus handles these things and fulfills
them. To the Son of God himself, yeah. Just incredible. So again, I want to remind you, remember Job's state of mind and state of body at this point. To him, verse 22, God was the one lifting him up to ride the storm. Until he melted away in the distance, God was treating him, in his mind, like a wicked man. Verse 23, he felt that God was going to bring him to death, to the house of Sheol. And in verse 24, that's a very difficult verse in 24. I'll read that for you real quick. He says in verse 24, "Surely he would not stretch out his hand against a heap of ruins if he cry out when he destroys it." The idea seems to be that is that Job feels like he's in a great fall, like falling off a cliff, and he's stretching out his hand for help to be caught, but no one is stretching out their hand to help him. No one is reaching back, and that seems to be the idea. He starts summing in verses 25 and 26. He says, "When he had wept for those in trouble, he had grieved for the needy. Job had looked for help. When he looked for help, evil came. And when he looked for light, darkness came." So the things that he had done for others was not being done to him. And you know, basic point here is this does not mean that God is indifferent. And this is a false conclusion that Job reaches due to God's silence. Just because God is silent doesn't mean he doesn't care. And I think, Duane, you have...
It seems like
To die. Right.
And he says, "I know you are going to bring me to die, but in the meantime, I'm in real pain."
Yeah.
"You're going to take me out of it, but I'd like it to happen right now."
Yeah. And he in his mind, at least what, you know, most of the commentaries I've read, Job feels that God is being indifferent. God doesn't care that he's in pain. And the point that all the commentators agreed on is to understand that just because things don't happen immediately to us in life does not mean God is indifferent. You know, any of us might go through a terrible bout with cancer and suffer for a long time. It does not mean God doesn't care. That's a false conclusion. And just because God is silent doesn't mean he doesn't care. And so, but that's some things that Job is drawing on. And we'll see these being answered at the end of the book when God talks to him. Let's wrap up here because we got to go quickly to chapter 31. Job's churning never stopped. Verse 27, he was searching within and he could not relax. The point being his physical and mental torture were just constant. He talks about mourning without sun. Dark mourning garments is the idea here. This is probably a reference to his skin from verse 30. His skin is blackened and it's falling off in chunks. He had cried to God and to men, but to no avail. Both were deaf to his plea. He says he's in out with the family. He's like a jackal. Jackals were scavengers and were symbol of desolation. He's out with the ostriches. They were a desert bird. Both symbolize Job's ostracism from society, his loneliness, and his longing for divine help and human sympathy. And this is, again, another reference, I think, in verse 30 to his skin condition. It appears that his skin had turned black from the disease, and as he was scraping it off, and it was peeling off from his flesh, and he says that his bones burned, and it's probably with the heat of fever. So whatever this condition he had, it caused all his bones to burn within him and to cause him to have a real high fever. Harps and pipes were instruments that were used for occasions of joy, but now these were being turned to play sadness and heaviness of spirit. And probably, as we would all know here as Christians, the only other person that could share Job's bed of suffering or somewhat understand even more so would be Jesus Christ himself, who not only went horrible suffering, but took on all the sin of the world. So that's Job's present state. And we're going to have to quickly go through. I've got like 7 minutes to get through the last chapter. In chapter 31, Job is going to go through a lot of if-then statements. And he's going to say, if I've done this, then let this happen to me. And it's kind of the blessing cursing. If I've done this and if I've done this, then let this happen to me. So we're going to go quickly through this. He starts off in verse 1. He says he had made a covenant with his eyes. He would not allow lust to be aroused by looking upon a young woman and to lust after her and cause him to sin. He would not look upon a woman with impure or lustful intentions. And he starts asking some questioning. He says, what is our share or our portion from God in this life? And this is where he gets back to orthodoxy a little bit. He says, well, the answer is calamity to the unrighteous and disaster to workers of sin. Well, that's kind of what his friends would agree with him about that, because that was orthodoxy view. Verse 4, God has seen all of Job's actions and behavior. God had numbers our steps. God knows our thoughts. And so Job then says, if Job had practiced falsehood or practiced deceit, then let him be weighed and let him be found either guilty or found innocent. Verse 7, he denies that he ever let his heart be enticed by his eyes and turned away his way of life to covet that which belonged to another. And if so, let his curse be upon him and let another enjoy the fruits of his labors. And he gets specifically here about talking about his neighbor's wife. He states that if his heart had not been open to lustful enticement, if he had not waited at his neighbor's door, if he had defiled his neighbor's wife, if he had done any of those kinds of things, to let his own wife become the servant, become the slave of another, and let her be sexually abused by them as well. He uses the expression, let her grind with another. And so he's using very graphic language that if I've done any of these lustful things, then let my wife go have sex with someone else, is basically what he's saying. Adultery, as we know, it was a very, very serious and outrageous crime, not only in our day, but in their day, and it was worthy of condemnation by a judge, by God and by man, and it was, of course, worthy of death. And it's a fire, we're told, that consumes a whole person, body, soul, and spirit. And I've got some verses there for you from Proverbs 6 and Proverbs 7. Point being is time doesn't change God's principles. Adultery was wrong in Job's day. Adultery is wrong in our day. What is morally true in Job's day is morally true in our day as well. Same things are the same thing. Sin is still sin. Job goes in now, and we start getting into these if-then statements. Job says that in verses 13 and 14, he had not disregarded or looked down upon his servants. He had always allowed them to defend their rights. There's a typo there. It should say Job had not disregarded. Job recognized that the same God that had molded and fashioned him had also molded and fashioned his fellow man, and they had been made from the same designer, is what the idea is in verse 15. Job here affirms his case for others with a series of if statements. He says, if he had withheld the poor from their desire, if he had caused the eyes of the widow to fail, if he had eaten alone and not shared with others, you know, he's saying, he's going to keep building. He's going to say, and eventually he's going to say, then let this happen to me. Verse 18, from his youth he had a concern for the welfare of others. And again he uses if statements. If he had seen any perish without clothing, if he had seen the needy with no covering, if he had let their loins not be blessed by him, if they had not been warmed by the fleece of his sheep. And he continues, if he had lifted his hand against the fatherless, if he had falsely taken advantage of anybody, and then tried to influence other judges at the gate, then, and now here's the then statement, then let his shoulder, which supports the arm, be removed from its socket, and the arm broken if he was guilty. And he's being a graphic example of, you know, then let this happen to me. It was not the fear of human judgment that restrained Job, it was the fear of God's judgment. And that should be our case as well for us as well. Job continues on, though, with the if statements, 24 and 25. He says, if gold was his hope, if fine gold was his confidence, if he rejoiced because of wealth, if he rejoiced because his hands were full, he continues on, if he had worshipped the sun or the moon, if he had let his heart or lips kiss an idol, God had always been his object of devotion and worship, not an idol. And idolatry denies all that God is in the creation as a designer. And idolatry, of course, like adultery, was punishable by death. He continues with the if statements. The same ifs are continuing. If he rejoiced at the destruction of an enemy, if he was lifted up when the evil was found with his enemy. And the point he's trying to say here is if Job denies he'd ever demonstrated any kind of evil, vindictive spirit to anybody, even against his enemies. And we're reminded Jesus tells us to love our enemies and pray for those that despise us and use us. 31 and 32, he continues the if statements. If the men of his tent had not been fed, if the traveler or the sojourner had not received open doors, Job had always practiced hospitality, and none could say that they didn't receive food or shelter when it was needed. If he was like Adam, Adam had tried to cover his sin, you might recall, but it could not be covered, it could not be hidden. Only God can provide us adequate clothing. Job had committed no open, no secret sin that he tried to hide in his bosom, not because of fear or contempt or terror of the multitudes. He had no hidden sin. And in verse 35, the idea is that he wants the Almighty to judge him. He says, let him weigh the evidence and render a verdict, because his adversary, in his mind, was still God. God was the giver, and God was also the adversary. If he was acquitted, Job says he would proudly carry his acquittal document upon his shoulder like an insignia, like an insignia of innocence. He would bind it upon himself like a crown. In his innocence, he would come near to God in the dignity of a prince. Job says, I know I'm innocent. I have not done these things. And we're going to, now the final slide here. He says, a few more if statements. He says, if the land cried out against him, if the furrows wept together, if he had eaten fruits without paying with it for money, if he had caused owners to lose their life, then let thistles grow instead of wheat. Thistles were a very prickly weed or thicket. Let cockles grow instead of barley. Cockles were a very noxious, stinky weed. In Hebrew, actually the word cockles means to stink. And then we come to, it says, the words of Job are ended. So as far as discussion with the other three friends, Job's discussion is over. He had silenced his three friends. Their traditional view that piety pays and perversity punishes was false. And the point being is, suffering is not always punishment for wrongdoing. And we know that. If there was some purpose to God allowing Job to suffer, it was not known to Job. Job just did not know why he was suffering. Any final thoughts before we let him in here? Okay, we're going to take a break next week. It's our gospel meeting, so we'll pick up next time with this young man by the name of Elihu in 2 weeks. Thank you, everybody.